Blog Talk Radio.
Guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
You know, I know we need to do a catch-up check-in on how the X-Files is going. We talked about that very briefly at the beginning of the show when the new X-Files started up. And we're going to have to catch
up. Have you been watching,
that.
Phil? Have you been catching those?
I have, yes. We're four in. There's two to go, right? I feel like
they've
got an awful lot to wrap up, you know. But then they always did have a lot to wrap up in that show, didn't they?
That's right. And they never really bothered to get around to that.
And never bothered to get around to wrapping it up. They would just throw you off in a completely new direction. But anyway, it just occurred to me that we hadn't checked in on that. Then I guess after the next two air and it's all out there in the public record, we can do a show where we spend some time talking about TV shows and we can get caught up in the X-Files. But I mentioned the X-Files because we're going to get into, if not the paranormal, at least we're pushing it out there just a little bit this evening. We're having a very special guest with us this evening, a man who's been with us before, and one of our favorite guests talking about one of our favorite topics. I'm pleased to introduce once again on The World Transformed, Jim Elvidge. Jim holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He's applied his training in the high-tech world as a leader in technology and enterprise management, including many years in executive roles for various companies and entrepreneurial ventures. He holds four patents in digital signal processing, and beyond the high-tech realm, he has years of experience as a musician, a writer, and a truth seeker. He merged his technology skills with his love of music, developed one of the first PC-based digital music samplers, and co-founded Radio Amp, the first private label online streaming radio company. Jim has spent many years researching the fields of quantum mechanics, cosmology, ancient history, consciousness, anomalous occurrences, and future technologies. He explored the interrelationship of these factors in his first book, The Universe Solved, and is currently working on a second book that digs deeper into the possibility of digital consciousness. Jim is also a contributor to our book, coming very soon, I promise you, The World Transformed, the abridged edition. Jim Elvidge, welcome back to The World Transformed.
Well, thank you very much, Phil and Steve. It's great to be back on the show.
It's awesome. Great to have you, and I hope you're not offended by my X-Files reference in bringing you on here.
No, not at all. In fact, I've got some opinions on the show myself. I've seen the four episodes.
We could totally go there.
I don't know.
Hey, you know,
yeah.
forget our topic.
We could probably talk for quite a bit about that.
But no, more important topics must intervene. We'll have you back. We'll do an X-Files show. So,
okay, cool.
I should have figured you were a fan. It only makes
sense. I have seen all of the episodes, and I've seen the new series as well, and I enjoyed them, but I guess a little bit disappointed with this season so far.
Well, okay, now you've said that, and I just want to say, Stephen, we won't get too deep, but Jim, did they cheat with the first episode? I mean, you know, isn't it just kind of a saying, you know, that mythology that you followed all those years, it wasn't really that, it's this. Did you feel cheated by that, or
Well, I think, like you said before, they've been doing that all along. You know,
that's true.
Is it Mulder or Scully who believes? You know what? And they're always getting duped, and then something will come along that'll reaffirm their faith. And the first episode felt to me like they were just trying to cram so much in there for viewers who didn't see the original series that it was a little bit, it was a little bit disjointed. But I guess the last episode maybe ties something together.
Kind of picked up after that.
That thing about always going back between the faith being reaffirmed or going the other direction, none of this is real. It seems like it's sort of a path we all kind of walk in a way. I think that's why I like X-Files. You go back and forth between faith and rationality all the time.
And I don't know. Yeah, and I think there's actually something
too deep for X-Files, but that's something I've always liked about the show. It can go either way. You just never know how the show is going to go down.
I agree. I think there's something significant about that too. The fact that you have a topic that that causes people to constantly push the envelope in discovery or experimentation or whatever, and that you never quite get there. I mean, science is the same way. Science never really gets to a full-on unified theory that explains everything, but they're always pushing the boundaries.
So true.
We had
absolutely
a significant thing happen this last week, didn't we? Jim, do you have any
discovery of gravity waves, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was very significant.
Absolutely. And, I would say let's push on with X-Files and talk about Gillian Anderson's hair. But you know what, guys? We just have only so much time. And I'm going to steer us in the direction of digital consciousness, because that is kind of what's been promised out on all the social channels here this evening. And I know Jim has some pretty interesting things to say on the subject. So, Jim, let's back it way up for those who are just hearing all this for the first time. And let's talk a little bit about, the case for digital reality, if you will. Can you give us, because we've talked about it before, but what are the biggest, best, most compelling, and especially if you've got new ones, reasons to believe that we're not living in the world that we think we're living in, that in fact we may be living in the Matrix? Show description here.
Yep, and we could really easily spend the entire show talking about different categories of evidence for this. I've spent so much time collecting it. Some of it's on the website. A lot of it was in the first book. Second book has a lot more. But I'd say, to answer your question quickly, it's probably one of the biggest reasons the smoking gun is some of the results of experimentation in the field of quantum mechanics. So, namely that the double slit experiment has been something that has kind of baffled quantum theorists for a long time. And what it shows is that it seems like the conscious observer has an impact on the result of the experiment. So there are always loopholes in this idea, and every couple of years, one more loophole gets closed and one more loophole gets closed. And it's become pretty clear recently that there are very few, if any, loopholes to be closed left. I keep on seeing, this is the final nail in the coffin of materialism, or this is the final nail in the coffin of objective reality and things like that. And there's always, one more experiment to be done to close that final loophole. But back in 2008, a physicist at Ikoki in Vienna, Austria, performed some really remarkable experiments that showed that objective reality doesn't exist. So that the conscious observer has an impact on reality directly. And since then, there have been experiments where the outcome of the experiment happens before the observer determines which direction the experiment should go. So it's they call it a retrocausal type of effect. And these kinds of things just don't happen in a deterministic, materialistic world. They happen in some other kind of world, and everybody's trying to figure out what that kind of world is. So that's really one of the main categories of evidence. There are a lot of categories of evidence that our reality is discrete or digital. then there are categories of evidence that consciousness is separate from the brain, that we have a duality type of approach going on. So I can talk about specific ones, but yeah, the main thing I think is quantum mechanics. The experiments going on there are really showing that subjective reality and the concept of locality, meaning forces, cause and effect, happen according to the normal laws of physics. That's even the boundaries of that have been pushed as well.
Now, if I understand the results of that double slit experiment. You get one set of results if somebody's watching, and you get a different set of results if nobody's watching, right? I mean, that's a gross oversimplification, but that's the bottom line, right? Somehow the observer is the presence of the existence of the observer provides an outcome, and not through anything the observer does, but simply by observing. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And
well,
isn't this analogous, Jim?
Isn't this analogous to saving processing in a computer game? You know, you don't necessarily render a 3D environment if the gamer is not there. You know, in that part of the game, you don't have to render that part of anything but what the observer is there to see.
Yeah, exactly.
Could it be analogous to that, or is it exactly that?
I think it's perfectly analogous to that. And in fact, if you think about this whole problem from the opposite standpoint, namely, how would I create a digital reality? Let's say I want to create the ultimate simulation or the ultimate digital game, fantasy game or something that people could play in. How would I do it? Well, certainly, I wouldn't need to model the inside of every single tree, or define the position of every atom or every particle in the universe at every point in time. There's no need to do that because that information is all unnecessary to the people who are actually having the subjective experience of that game. So I'd use all kinds of shortcuts. I would do things like make everything in sort of a probability space so that nothing is really nailed down until somebody actually dives deep and determines a position or a velocity or some attribute of that particle. And that's exactly what seems to be happening. So, one example is the idea of entanglement, quantum entanglement. You know, here you have two particles that are interacting with each other at some point, and they become entangled in the sense that they act exactly like, not necessarily like one particle, but one state machine, effectively. So whatever one does, the other one does. So, or the other one does the opposite or something related to it. And you can take these particles and theoretically separate them by light years. And this was something that Einstein had a thought experiment about this exact thing back in, I think it was 1935. Theoretically separate these particles by light years, make a measurement on one, and instantly the position or the measurement on the other one is determined. So it's almost like they know what each other is doing, but there can't be communication at that speed because that violates the speed of light limit. So a lot of people have been talking about things like a holographic environment, that there's this, David Bohm talked about the implicate order, so an underlying connectedness of all things. So if you could imagine that you've got this particle light years away from another particle, two of them are entangled, and yet somehow they're connected in a different dimension that we can't even see, and that dimension isn't subject to the laws of relativity, then it all makes sense. But what is that dimension? And what I'm saying is that dimension is the fact that it is a digital system. In a digital system, everything happens in a clock cycle. So if I need to paint one corner of the screen and something else is going on in another corner of the screen, or in a different virtual environment, say I've got thousands of people playing a game, and every clock cycle, the whole state of that game is going to change. Well, that state of the game can change no matter how far they are apart in virtual miles. It's going to change instantly because those changes are made with every single clock cycle of the game. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. When you hear that,
I'm following.
It makes me wonder. Well, If that's the case, right? There's a there's a computer running the whole program, and you know, thanks to the miracle of clock cycles, we can actually have things occur simultaneously without the intervening need for a time lag, because these things have been what is the exact term? They're entangled, right? At the quantum,
yes.
At the quantum level. I guess my question is, what does that say about the reality that where the computer is running, right? Does that tell us anything about that at all? Do we understand anything about it? Is it a continuous reality? Is it digital too? Is it you know what I'm saying? It's like,
sure.
Have we just taken a lot of problems and pushed pushed them under a rug with a kind of an intriguing sounding cover over it?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that if you how do I put this? If you discover that there's a whole nother level of existence, that's significant and that's worth talking about and exploring and trying to understand. But if you've discovered that there's probably another level of existence or a level of reality that you can't access, then it's almost pointless. But it's interesting that you've discovered that, and it maybe says something about your position in the greater reality. So one example is there's a concept called Hilbert space. In some theories of quantum mechanics, every time a quantum mechanical decision is made, a universe forks off, one with has the one decision and one that has the other decision. Should this the spin of this particle be up or down, left or right, one or zero? Yes, it's both. And in one universe, it's one, and in one universe, it's the other. So there are constantly zillions of these universes forking off in that way. Well, that's great, except that you can't get from one universe to another. There's nothing that allows that in the Hilbert space theory. Similarly with the other way of looking at parallel realities, you've probably heard of this kind of thought experiment. Do I have a doppelganger somewhere? Is there somebody who is built exactly like me, looks exactly like me, talks like me, has the same identical makeup as I am? Yes. If the universe is infinite, you can actually calculate how far out you would have to go to find an organization of matter that perfectly matches yours, because randomly you throw a bunch of stuff together, eventually something is going to duplicate. So that's another one where I'm never going to see my doppelganger, too far away, can't ever exceed the speed of light, that kind of thing. But knowing that exists really changes your view of reality. It's kind of like going from the geocentric view of the world to the heliocentric view of the world, and then the discovery of galaxies, it completely puts you in your place, essentially.
Right. Although, if we are living in a digital simulation, essentially, maybe I don't have a doppelganger, right? I mean,
right.
Yeah, because this could be the only one that's even remotely like this running, and the whole rest of the universe is so different from this that I don't show up anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And that's – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's like the universe can almost become a lot smaller.
Yes.
If you follow this line of thought, right? What Stephen said earlier about, the parts of the universe you're not looking at aren't even there, right? We did a show about Fermi paradox. Stephen, was that last week or the week before, talking about, where are all the aliens? Well, parsimonious programming would be one explanation, wouldn't it? It's like, well, you don't want to add all that because it uses all those compute cycles, right? So why would there just be one civilization in the whole universe? Well, it's because that's all they have the compute cycles to run, right? So they created
perhaps they live in the next cycle up or whatever. It's United Federation of Planets out there, but they want to just see what a single civilization developing all on its own would look like. Who knows?
And a lot of it kind of gets to your question about where is the computer? What is the other reality that's underlying all of this, or sort of outside of this? And this is where there are a couple of different directions you can go. People who talk about simulation theory, I kind of don't like the word simulation because it implies that it's not real. I think that what we are experiencing is as real as you can get. I think by intent, we're supposed to have real experiences, and subjective experiences are real. It's real to our consciousness. But the idea of a simulation is that, well, somebody else did that, maybe an AI, maybe an extraterrestrial civilization, maybe us in the future, maybe we're playing in simulations. Humanity is really in the year 2200 or something like that, and we're experiencing some simulation. Now, that seems odd to me. I mean, why would I spend a whole lot of time doing laundry and things like that? You know, if I'm going to play out some fantasy simulation in the future, I'm going to do something a little bit more, you know, interesting than you know, what my day normally consists of. But so there could be other reasons for it. It could be a prison type of thing. But anyway, the simulation does imply that there's some other entity out there that has created this. But that's not the only way you could get a digital reality. In fact, Tom Campbell and I and Stephen Kaufman and some others really tend to believe that the evidence points more toward a system that has evolved on its own, that all that there is, you know, we can hardly even use the word universe anymore because people have this vision of the universe as the physical thing that we can see with telescopes. So it's unfortunate I can't use the word universe to mean all that there is. But if you could imagine all that there is this big digital consciousness construct, if it has a rule of continuous improvement and it works in an evolutionary way where it tries something, it's always trying to get better, it's always trying to improve its level of consciousness or its quality level, then eventually it's going to create learning situations like our reality where we interact with it and we develop. So this is a case where there isn't a big grand designer. The system itself designed itself. How did it boot up? I mean, that's kind of a mystical thing, but no matter what origin of reality you're talking about, you're going to have this question of where is the initial part. And at least within the simulation world or the digital reality world, there's some rationale behind saying, well, it could have just booted up. You know, a program just boots up and the whole construct of the program, the data structures and the elements that are in there can start from zero. When we talk about the Big Bang Theory, nobody has an explanation for how that got booted up, how that started. But if this is a simulation, there's a real explanation for the origin of everything. It was a boot up.
Right, right. That's really interesting. It starts to make your brain hurt a little bit when you think of digital reality that evolved on its own. But I hear what you're saying. It's not really any different from just looking at a galaxy and seeing it as part of this massive structure that somehow evolved on its own, right? Whether
right.
it's digital or the physical universe that we took it for prior to starting to look at it in different ways, somehow or other you get to tremendous complexity from a less complex state. So yeah, that's one of the great mysteries, I guess, of existence. And what you're saying is, while there's some thoughts on digital reality that account for that, the simulation hypothesis, which is that, you know, Stephen is just a, you know, joker, and 100 years from now he writes this program because he thinks it's funny or whatever, and we're stuck here.
Right. and just for fun, we're going to make Jim do laundry.
Yeah, I'll spend the rest of my life doing laundry.
Wait, another
that's
one,
my...
DMV. I'm going to give Phil bad eyesight, and he has to go to the DMV.
That's
going to be awesome.
That's our karma.
Yeah, exactly. So it's what's cool about that is, you know, you can go either way, right? You can say, well, there's this you get into all kinds of trouble using any language around this, but right, there's some kind of intelligent design behind it, or it's happening organically, you know, for causes that we can't understand, but ultimately that it's digital. I think one of the things we need to separate out here is, in fact, I think in the email, most recent email you sent me, you kind of split this into two points, is that nature is digital, but also maybe equally important point that you're promoting is that consciousness is separate from the brain. Now, do those two things is one necessary for the other? Could you live in a digital nature where consciousness was still part of the brain? Could you live in a, you know, natural world where consciousness was separate from the brain? What do those two things have to do with each other? Part one of the question. And part two, why do you think that consciousness is separate from the brain? Sorry.
Sure. So they are two very separate concepts, and yet they work together beautifully. And you could have a digital reality that is completely deterministic. So imagine that you are, as an analogy, let's imagine that you are playing in a video game, but you have really no control over your avatar. You're just watching the thing go through the motions and make decisions, and get shot by the monsters or whatever it is. That would be a pretty frustrating experience for a conscious entity like ourselves, but that would be a deterministic digital reality. And there are a lot of people who believe that our reality is like that, regardless of whether it's digital. They believe that in the end, every decision that we make is really an illusion, because the decision is made by the nature of the particles that are in our brain, the state of all of our neurons, synapse firings, and the influx of stimuli that we get, and that just basically creates a deterministic world that we just live through and have this illusion that we have free will and control over it. So that is one aspect of a possible digital reality. And the original guys, people like Conrad Zuse and Ed Fredkin and others, that tended to be the way they looked at things. They thought, deep down underneath, everything is probably digital. Matter is made of bits, and these things follow rules that are already set in place, and there's not much you can do about it. The other possibility is that we do have free will. Well, if we have free will, we almost have to be somehow outside of, the digital constructs of our brain. I have a hard time understanding how free will and consciousness can arise, emerge out of complexity of a brain function. But there's a lot of evidence for the idea that our consciousness is separate from the brain. Near-death experiences that are so, they're so clear that it's impossible for them to have happened due to a dying brain. The traditional argument against that is that, it's due to the lack of oxygen in the brain. Well, there are fighter pilots that get a lack of oxygen in the brain and they pass out. They don't have these experiences. People only have these experiences under certain circumstances, and they have a lot of common characteristics. And by the way, these characteristics have happened over the millennia in all kinds of different cultures that weren't connected with each other. So people have been reporting near-death experiences with common types of characteristics for a long time. Some of these experiences, you have mysteries about them or corroborating artifacts. Somebody's floating over their hospital bed when they're completely flatlined and they're watching exactly what's going on in the operating room, and then they talk about it later on, like right afterwards, and it's impossible to explain because they were flatlined at that time. I would get into this a lot more, but that is one good category of evidence. There's also a lot of evidence. People have written papers, and when I say people, I mean scientists, researchers, have written papers and books on past life experiences. There seems to be a real good deal of evidence that people reincarnate. There was a case not too long ago of a little boy who was 3 years old, and he started talking about experiences that he had in World War II as a pilot, and his plane went down, and you probably have seen some of the stories about this. But these are the kind of things that he had no way of knowing. He named people. He named the place where he was, and when they went back and found the individual that was his past life, it all matched. He ended up speaking with his dad, ended up speaking with their relatives, and found out that what his little boy was talking about was all accurate. So there are plenty of things like this. Paranormal experiences are unexplained. Now, you could say, there's another force out there. We have electromagnetic force, and we have strong nuclear and weak nuclear, and we have mental energy that nobody's figured out how it works. So somebody could say there's a scientific explanation for the subtle effects that we see in terms of telepathy and remote viewing and things like that. But they are actually, beyond a reasonable doubt, real effects, statistically significant results if you look at all of the experiments that have been done on these things. So it could be explained by an unknown aspect of physics, or it could be explained by the fact that we are really separate from our bodies and we are able to remote view because we're able to connect to something, you know, in a distant way. And all it is digital data that our consciousness is processing. We just, you know, we're normally focused on our local reality, but under certain circumstances, when we clear our mind, when we meditate or whatever, we can focus on other aspects of the reality that are out there.
One thing that must be true, whether conscious is a local phenomenon in the brain or whether it exists elsewhere, it's somehow associated with the brain. The brain must be a tremendous catalyst for consciousness, particularly the human brain, right? Because we seem to, you know, even if you're, I can't think of the word, one of the folks who believes that consciousness, you know, kind of permeates everything, it does seem to get very concentrated.
Panpsychism.
Yeah, even if you go for panpsychism, right, it seems that the consciousness gets really concentrated in human brains, right? And it's like the one place where we know it's taking place, or it's associated with it, right? Well, I won't say it's taking place there, but this, you know, somehow it's awfully closely connected with brains, right? Whether brains are producing it or not, you know.
Maybe you could think of it as sort of a radio. You know, and animals have some form of consciousness, but maybe not as advanced because the radio is not quite as good. I don't know.
I do kind of think of it that way. I you know, I think that's the mistake that a lot of neuroscientists say. They put probes in the brain and generate some stimulus. Think about cake or whatever it is, and oh, it lights up over here. Or think about this experience that you had and say, oh, look at the electrical activity in this part of the brain. Oh, therefore, consciousness must be emerging from the brain. Well, that doesn't mean that at all. That's a completely fallacious argument. Because if you put an oscilloscope on a circuit in your TV, you're going to see all kinds of activity going on, but the programming is not coming from the TV. The programming is coming from somewhere else. So, you know, the experience that the TV is having essentially in playing some program or something like that is not coming from its own circuitry. It's being processed by its circuitry. It's allowing that circuitry to display it on a screen, or maybe in the human brain case, it's allowing us to interact with our world. It's allowing us to collect data and send it back to our consciousness.
You know, there's a part of me that hears that, and I just want to. I guess it's having spent so many years around, you know, just the intense materialist type thinkers. I just want to say, yeah, but come on, Occam's razor. Isn't it a lot easier just to think it's all happening in the brain? I mean, ultimately, right, you know, we have brains, we're conscious. Doesn't it just make more sense to say that that's probably where it's coming from and why we have consciousness?
Yeah, it might make more sense, but it's analogous to walking around the city that you live in and saying, oh, the earth is flat because I don't see any curvature. Once you start looking at the other evidence, in other words, you know, the pictures that are taken from satellites, or in the case of the what we're talking about with respect to the materialism side of things, when you look at the observer effect in quantum mechanics experiments, you have to realize, well, that you have to throw out that idea. So let's talk about the observer effect. How is it possible that I can influence the outcome of an experiment by observing it? You know, if I don't have a separate consciousness, what is it about the things that are going on in the synapses in my brain that are causing that screen over there to show an interference pattern or not an interference pattern? And it's just a knowing that causes that. It's not like a concentration, like I'm trying to send more energy to the apparatus to make it do something different. It's just a knowing, an awareness of which slit the particles are going through that makes that collapse. That knowing, there's nothing that can explain that in a kind of reductionist way. So I think that's just, you know, you have to say, let's take the evidence for what it is. Occam's razor would say consciousness is separate from the brain. The materialists who have been deeply ingrained in that world and that philosophy, and that's what their research is based on and their whole foundation is based on, they're fighting it tooth and nail. They're coming up with, you know, all kinds of loopholes and possibilities, and when they finally can't figure it out, they move on to the next experiment and argue about that one. So to me, I don't have anything at stake. I don't have a career at stake in physics, where if I say something that's kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit, that I'm going to lose my tenure or my funding or something like that. I'm kind of just sitting back and connecting the dots and looking what's going on in artificial intelligence and in quantum physics and cosmology and thinking about it philosophically and all these kind of things, and just saying, where's the evidence leading?
Although I don't think it's the physicist's tour. Go ahead, Stephen.
I was just going to say that, you know, it's Sherlock Holmes's corollary to the Occam's razor. You know, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So maybe
right.
that's it. You know, yeah, the simplest answers usually are the are correct, but sometimes you have to, you have to go a little past that if the simple no longer explains what you're seeing.
Exactly. Yeah. Your theory of reality has to explain everything, or you don't have a complete theory. With respect to Occam's razor, the whole idea of the finely tuned universe is a perfect example. We see that the ratio of the weight of a proton to the weight of an electron, if it was off by, you know, one part in a billion or something, we wouldn't exist. Matter wouldn't exist. If the rate of expansion of the early universe was off by, you know, the tiniest fraction of a percentage, the universe would have imploded on itself, or it would have been flown apart so fast that matter could never have formed. So there are, you know, a dozen of these kinds of anomalies that make it look like our universe was designed for not just for life, but for matter to actually exist in it. So Occam's razor is actually, there was a designer, but the alternate explanation is actually outlandish. And the alternate explanation is that there are so many zillions and zillions of universes that have collapsed, that have done all of these other things. Every possible, you know, combination of fundamental attributes that created benign universes, empty universes out there, they all exist. And so the only one that supports life is going to be the one that we live in. It's a combination of the anthropic principle and the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's, to me, highly illogical. That's not a simple explanation at all. That's just crazy.
Well, to me, it's kind of desperate, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you kind of hide the improbability of it all with the fact, well, we're having the conversation, aren't we? Yeah. Well, then it had to work that way. Oh, well, okay.
Right.
Then I don't know why we brought it up, but you know, when you and actually you run into the same thing with consciousness, because, and we've spent a lot of time talking around consciousness on this program over the years, so I can say with confidence that even if you grant that it's going on in the brain, right? You know, if you're up against somebody and it's like, no, it's definitely, you know, it's a physical process in the brain, and anybody who thinks otherwise is a crazy, you know, religious fanatic. It's like, okay, granted, it's happening in the brain. Now tell me what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation is done, right? Because nobody has a good, like, explanation of even what consciousness is.
Exactly.
As far as I know, if they do, they've come up with it very recently, because we've looked into this and no one explains it very well. So it's like it might as well be taking place outside of the brain, right? We don't know anything else about it. You know, how can we exclude anything about consciousness? Really, when you come right down to it, it's really the biggest mystery we face.
I think it absolutely is. I agree.
You know, and it's also, of course, the fundamental to our facing anything. But there you have it. That's
well,
the paradigm.
I hate to go totally sci-fi on you, Jim, but I need to ask this question. If we have a perfectly functioning transporter, do we make the trip? does consciousness, does Captain Kirk have something to worry about with his consciousness? Now, I mean, this is completely silly, perhaps, but if you're correct in these ideas, then perhaps he doesn't have anything to worry about.
It's a terrific question, and I actually saw, as an aside, I saw something recently where some physicists were proposing a way to send memories. So given that memory is generally thought of as a component of consciousness, at least, you know, got people excited about the possibility that yes, in the future, we might be able to actually transport our consciousness too. But let me just say real quickly that from all of the research that I've done and the evidence that I've compiled, here's what I think actually goes on. I think that our consciousness is a separate part of all that there is. All that there is organized information, if you will. I think matter deep down is nothing but information. I think our consciousness is nothing but organized information. I think Tom Campbell said it well, and he said consciousness is organized bits. And so you have, think of yourself as being in this cloud, this individuated portion of a big, huge cloud of all that there is consciousness. Then there's a separate cloud, if you will, that's called a reality, you know, a reality learning lab. This is our physical reality. We connect to it when we're alive, and we say, well, I'm going to be this kind of person. We, you know, have a little bit of control over our next life. A lot of the mystical experiences have kind of lent themselves toward this direction. So we make a decision on what kind of things we need to learn and how we need to evolve ourselves, our consciousness, and we connect to some template of a human in this digital reality structure, and you say, okay, we're going to go on and live our lives now. So what does that have to do with transporting? Well, the transporting happens within that digital reality simulation, if you will. So if your consciousness says, okay, I'm happy with going to the place where they're going to create a carbon copy of me and occupying that template, then yes, you could transport. I think it's up to the consciousness. I don't think we've understood enough about the power of intent or the power of a consciousness to occupy a living entity or a living template or a vehicle, that allows it to achieve its expression. We haven't researched that very well yet, but I suspect that that's the way it happens, that it's not that it emerges from a complex set of data in a brain, that the consciousness decides to choose that as the template for the experience that it's going to have in this particular lifetime. So let's say at some point maybe we have silicon, we have AI that's sufficiently complex enough for a consciousness to want to experience what it's like to be in that. Maybe that connection can be made and we would actually have a conscious AI. But I don't think it's going to attain consciousness on itself. I think that's happening from the separate consciousness.
Okay, this brings us to one of the points that we wanted to touch on was you said you wanted to talk a little about the transhumanist movement. What makes sense about it? What doesn't make sense about it? Perhaps AI is one of those things that doesn't necessarily make sense. But step us through that. What do you think when you look at it through this lens, through the lens of digital consciousness? What makes sense about the transhumanist movement and what doesn't make much sense?
Well, I think what makes sense is that we are having this subjective experience in this life and we are progressing in terms of knowledge. So, you know, even if we're playing a simulation in this simulation, and again, I don't like the word, but I don't have a better one. So in this reality that we're interacting with, we are following the scientific method, we're following technology, we're moving forward with things that we think are going to enhance our life in some way. So the transhumanist movement is about that. It's about enhancing your brain, enhancing your body, those kinds of things, maybe genetic manipulation, and so on and so forth. And some of that is going to happen. It's definitely going to happen, and maybe it's all it can be good stuff. I don't know. I mean, there's a danger to every new technology, but we seem to tend to outpace the danger for some reason. The part that I have a problem with is the idea of immortality, the idea that we're chasing immortality in the physical realm, because I see what it does. It has a huge impact on society. It causes people to live 20 years beyond their normal lifespan and die without dignity. It causes pharmaceutical companies to have a tremendous amount of power. It causes people to think differently. But on the other hand, if you recognize that you're already immortal, that your consciousness, that your soul, if you will, exists out there in information space, you don't need to worry about the physical immortality. You're going to reincarnate anyway. You are already immortal. So that the knowledge of that makes you behave differently. It makes you, instead of competing for a finite set of resources that we have in our reality, it might make you more cooperative. It might make you more, open to bigger things and improving the quality of your life rather than just extending the duration of it.
Now, the materialists are going to say you're just making a religious argument that they've already walked away from years ago, right? That's the crux of what you just said, right? You could be a good mm-hmm. person, and then you'll have a nice afterlife, and so you don't need to worry about this material extension of your life because it's all taken care of and built into the system, and now you can just be focus on being a good person, which is what you were supposed to do. How would you respond to that objection?
Well, I'm not sure what the objection there is. Tell me what the objection is.
No, that's true.
I don't think I quite got it.
Well, the objection is that you're just reintroducing religious beliefs that they've already stepped away from.
Well, they stepped away from them, but they didn't. They stepped away from them because of materialist dogma. You know, I think materialism is just as much of a religion as a religion. It's not really based on the evidence anymore. So that's fine that they stepped away from it. But how are you going to explain all of the things that we've talked about tonight? How are you going to explain past lives and the observer effect and near-death experience or shared death experiences or PSI or the fact that the universe is finely tuned? You know, how do you explain all that stuff with your materialist point of view? You can't, really.
Well, you don't explain it. You just call it woo, right? You write your skeptics' wikis and you call it woo, and you try not to think about
exactly.
it any more than you have to. Yeah.
Yeah, and you come up with the nastier words to call the people who are thinking outside of the box.
Now, I do want to say a word about the life extension movement. My friends involved in that would object to the idea that they want to extend life, that they want to extend feebleness and senility. That in fact, what they're looking for is extension of the health span of the individual, and making us live longer and feel better, right? Not
sure.
This kind of grotesque thing that occurs today. But I like the idea of kind of flipping it on its head. Let me ask you a question. If we've established, if there really is proof that objective reality, quote unquote, doesn't exist, that what we ultimately come down to, all of us, is a series of subjective experiences, should not the logical goal be just to create the best possible set of subjective experiences for the largest group of people that you can possibly have? Is that too simple-minded, or does that just kind of follow from those premises?
No, I think you're right. I think that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to have subjective experiences that we can learn and evolve from.
And if we got that right first, if we focused on that first, then maybe, yeah, you can make it last longer or not make it last longer, right? Because ultimately, if the world is like this bad, evil, dangerous place, maybe trying to live forever isn't the first order of business, right? Maybe it's fixing some of these other issues ahead of time. But I look at, you know, I look at some of the ways that we could give people subjective experiences. We, you know, we were talking about you know, the efforts of I can't think of the name of the movement now, but the people who just want to eliminate all suffering. Stephen, what's that group called? We had them on.
Hedonists, or what are you talking about?
Yeah, thank you. The hedonistic imperative, absolutely right.
To
eliminate all suffering. Well, there's a lot of different ways you can do that, and you know, they talk about doing it through genetically modifying humanity and so forth. And you know, one of my big fixes for it is virtual reality. But does virtual reality take on a different meaning, right? When you start with the assumption that even actual reality is essentially virtual, right? I mean,
yes.
Does it sort of make a case for virtual reality almost?
Well, I think that I think it is virtual, and that's one of the problems that we have in coming up with words, descriptions for things, because people will use the word reality. It means very different things in very different contexts, and virtual reality and physical reality. I think our physical reality is very virtual, but to be honest, our subjective experience is as real as it can be. It's kind of
right.
Like, what one thing do you know? You know that you're aware. That might be the only thing that you can know for sure. You can't be guaranteed that what you think happened yesterday actually happened. They find that people's memory is subject to a lot of changes. Every time you recall something, your brain changes a little bit. It's almost like that telephone game or whisper down the lane. So two people could have be in the same proximity, and a week later you ask them questions about what happened, and you'll get different answers because the way they're pulling information out of their memory is just getting modified all along. Or you could use the argument that our whole reality started last Thursday. It's something called last Thursdayism, it's a thought experiment. It started last Thursday, and all of these artifacts were placed in there. So in other words, the point I'm trying to make is that you're never really 100% sure of anything that was in the past. You certainly can't be 100% sure of things in the future. The only thing you can really be sure of is that you're aware right now.
Right. Well, in the Dilbert future, Scott Adams, one of his books of essays, talks about what he calls the holodeck fallacy. He says that we'll never invent holodecks because if we do, that's the end of all human civilization, right? Because once you have the holodeck, everybody just goes in there, you know, every guy goes in there and he's got his own, like, virtual, you know, Megan Fox or whoever, and he's good, right, for the rest of his life, right? It's just, you know, you don't need anything else. You got the holodeck to just give you, you know, whatever it is you want. But really, if you start with the assumption that everything's subjective anyway, you know, why would you argue against saying, okay, well, next Thursday is going to be the starting point, you know, it'll be the ultimate last Thursday, and we'll just reboot, and we're just going to start piping the most pleasant experiences that we possibly can. I mean, obviously, you have to have a technological infrastructure to support that, but there's no argument that I can see against doing that.
As an analogy, and this gets into my professional world, we teach that failure is a good word. Failure is not something you should avoid or be ashamed of. We actually learn through failure. We learn much more through failure than repeating the same successes over and over again. You know, even take a football team. When they lose a game, they're going to learn something about, you know, how many holes they had in their defense, or, you know, what they didn't count on, or you know, something like that. But if they just keep winning over and over, they're not really learning. They're not improving. They're not able to get enough input for them to go on and make a progressive change. So I think suffering, evil, if you want to call it that, the negative side of things. You know, the Buddhists always had this duality of plus and minus, good and bad, black and white, and everything has to exist in reference to each other, or you can't learn and you can't evolve.
So that's why they put the laundry in the simulation, right? I mean, finally.
Maybe, but that seems to be kind of a mundane thing to learn to me. But you know, it's the same thing with relationships. If the one relationship you had was perfect, you wouldn't really learn how to get along with different people. you wouldn't really learn how to be patient or learn how to be generous, perhaps, or something like that. It's when you have challenging situations that you evolve your consciousness, evolve your soul. So eliminating all suffering, I don't think that makes sense.
Wow. Interesting. This is just absolutely fascinating. And this makes me want to do another one of our big world transformed multi-panel discussions here and get people in and hash through some of these things. I tell you, the eliminating all suffering sounds pretty good, but Jim, your argument is making an awful lot of sense as well. And there's so much that we aren't going to have time to get to tonight. We're probably not going to revisit the Berenstain Bears, although you'll be happy to know, Jim, we've already done two shows about that. And
good.
My sister
did
actually
you come up with any good conclusions?
No. Well, yeah. No good ones. No solid ones. But I was just going to say, my sister wants that just to be the only thing we talk about on the show. She wants this to become like the Berenstain Bears show. And you know, I've thought about it. I don't think we're gonna go that route.
Well,
you know,
there's probably an alternate reality film where we tried that, but I'm glad that we're not in that reality.
Yeah, there's another world where we're doing that every week. It's talking about that for sure.
Yeah, so I have an idea for you. See if you can change the name of your show and change every single artifact on the web and say it was always that way.
We kind of did that recently.
Maybe
you know what? We tried. We were the. This is great, Stephen. This is wonderful. You know why? Because we tried to do that, right? We were Fast Forward Radio, and then we became the World Transformed. And you know what? I was looking at one of the places on the home site of the show last week, 3 years after this change, and it still said Fast Forward Radio.
Fast Forward.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, it's hard to.
It's hard to get rid of all the artifacts.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, so what are you saying?
mess with your listeners for fun.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. We try to do that as much as we possibly can anyhow. But that is a fun one. I see that one as more entertaining than anything else. I look at that one and I go, oh, that can't be right. You know, I mean, surely whatever's happening would be coherent enough that you wouldn't have that kind of stuff happening. I mean, if I were writing science fiction, I would throw that kind of stuff in. But it almost offends me a little to think that I would live in such a sloppy universe. I guess that's where I stand on the Berenstain Bears, ultimately. Do I have my head in the sand, perhaps?
No, I think the sloppiness is maybe unintentional, or it could be by design. But again, this has caused us to do what? It's caused us to inspect reality, to kind of push the boundaries a little bit. So maybe it was the system throwing a monkey wrench into our world a little bit to get us to start thinking differently. I don't know.
We are almost out of time, and one of the things that I wanted to get to was predictions of digital consciousness theory. So, Jim, in 1 minute, 60 seconds, give us what does digital consciousness theory tell us about what happens next, or what does it predict for us?
Oh, good. I don't have a pat answer for that, but let me see what I can come up with off the top of my head. So I'm going to vamp for a little bit while I'm thinking. No. All right,
fine.
So one possibility would be to say that anything that can happen in a video game context, in a virtual reality type scenario, could occur in our reality. So one thing might be the apparent exceeding of the speed of light. That and there was something recently, I don't know if it was neutrinos again or something else, that some scientists were thinking they spotted some faster than light particles. But in a digital consciousness reality, we should be able to exceed the speed of light. Maybe not exceed it in our normal day-to-day business, because that would, you know, change things to the point where our laws of physics wouldn't make sense, and we've come up with these through our own research and so forth. But as an anomalous occurrence, there's no reason why we couldn't have something occurring on one part of the universe and, you know, having an identical thing occurring on the opposite end of the universe that would apparently exceed the speed of light. So
the entanglement thing kind of buys us that, right? So one of the potential, if this is the right word, applications of that. Well, Jim, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed, and I know I speak for Stephen, speaking with you this evening. It's been too long since we've done this. I know you're working on a book, so when you get the book done, let's have you back again very soon, and let's continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Very happy to, and it was a pleasure. It went really fast. Stephen, Phil, really great to talk to you guys again.
Always a pleasure having you on. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Our music tonight is Moons by Slow Corpse.
Slow Corpse with Moons. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks once again to Jim Elvidge and for all of you for being with us. We will be back again on Sunday evening with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.
I said